founded upon the premise that it is possible for man to establish an intimate relationship with the presence of divinity in his own consciousness. More advanced people become in the prayer phenomena, the less likely they are to turn this prayer toward changing outside things. The more likely they are to cause this prayer to be a means of fortifying their spiritual resolution to become better people. The prayer mystery, as we find it in the early Gospels, is that its purpose is to inspire the person to be better. And by the healing of the illnesses in his own psychic nature, to relieve himself of the outward manifestation of these illnesses in the form of misery, sorrow, and pain. Thus, the man who conquereth himself, who establishes his own spiritual integration, becomes, in a sense, superior to the problems which exist around him, but not because he has taken an autocratic or despotic attitude toward these problems and resolved or demanded that they be removed. The next question that arises with this whole situation is also clarifying itself gradually as man's general knowledge enlarges. Is prayer, as we know it, as a simple and devout statement, is prayer a force? Does it have a validity, a dynamic of its own? Is it merely something that man strengthens with his own determination, with his faith, and with his acceptance? Or does prayer phenomena actually have a living vitality of its own? The turn of the century, the scientific mind would have rejected such a possibility almost completely. Now, even the more hardened scientist is not quite so sure. And the tendency today is to admit that there may be a definite vitality in the prayer procedure, if that procedure is correct. And if the elements involving the process are right in themselves and according to the laws governing such phenomena in life, laws which we do not understand too well, but one of which, apparently, at least dimly, is to be perceived by us, namely that selfishness makes all things go bad, that we are beginning to sense beyond any reasonable doubt. The rest is not quite so clear. Nothing has contributed more to the recognition of the possible existence of a spiritual energy or vitality in space than the development in radio and the consequent development in television. Here we have come face to face with the reality of an invisible energy that is not only present, but when the proper equipment is established, can be caused to reaffirm itself, either through sound or through visibility. Thus we have now the proof that we do not have to see a thing in order to say it is there. Invisible energies and rays that we now know exist move through this room. And though we cannot see them, we cannot deny them. Thus, the possibility of the reality of invisible has been brought very strongly home to us. Another department of thinking has also added to this, and that has been gradual experimentation in the field of psychic phenomena. This experimentation, as expressed through the extrasensory perception researches of several men, has come to be of general interest, not only to the layman, but to the scientist. And there is a large group of scientists today convinced that extrasensory perception is true. And that means the reality of varying degrees of clairvoyance, thought transmission, and the projection of thought to persons or conditions at a distance, and the anticipation in the mind or in the consciousness of events which have not yet occurred. These and other forms indicate a larger area of human experience than we have previously recognized. Thought transference in itself means that the mental energy of an individual can be transferred to another individual, or can be picked up, as in the case of a radio wave, and that the second person or the receiver can reorganize this thought impulse into its original meaning and register it so upon his own consciousness. If there be, therefore, any transmission of energy from one person to another along lines of mental or emotional intensity, then we have every reason to assume the power of collective mental energy upon any situation or condition that arises. We also realize that the more powerful a broadcasting station, the wider its range, the clearer its image, and the more it is likely to overcome the interference of weaker stations. We therefore also recognize the accumulative power of collective thought, and the possibility that this accumulative power can be responsible for a number of phenomena which we have been attempting, rather inadequately, to explain in other ways. We also have a reason and considerable evidence to support the concept that cumulative or individual thought is not nearly as perishable as we assume. A thought that moves out from us into space does not necessarily evaporate. Thought in all possibilities may survive the body, and the thoughts of men may factually and actually live long after them. Not on printed pages or in the memories of others, but as living forces in the world itself. So if the recent researches continue as they have, and there is every reason to assume they will, there seems no slowing of the pace. In fact, it is getting more exhilarated continuously. We are moving into a universe in which the exchange of mental and emotional energy by projection of thought and feeling may well become an orthodox and well-known fact. If such occurs, then we have the logical and proper ground for realizing that this means of communication, or this means of dissemination of ideas, thoughts, or knowledge, is not limited to experimental endeavors, but that across this interval, these waves can transmit innumerable types of impact, and that this impact will be received not merely as a do-so or do-not-so impulse, but as a very powerful experience impulse. The extrasensory gamut form of communication may ultimately result in the possibility of the communication of experience, or the communication of the factual living of events. But the individual will not listen or look, but will feel totally within himself, and will therefore actually experience what others have experienced. This actual communication of experience may well be the beginning of real understanding between human beings. Burbank once told me that he was quite certain that plants and flowers could be affected by human attitudes of varying degrees of intensity. Because of his natural instinct, and because, although a devout man, he was an untheological man, and was therefore regarded as an agnostic, Mr. Burbank held firmly the power of communion between man and nature. He insisted and told me very firmly that he completely believed that plants and probably animals, not able to understand or even hear the words that we spoke, or not having any knowledge of the type of vocabulary or the meaning of our word dimensions in life, we're able to receive telepathically a clear insight as to our meaning, that other kingdoms contacted us on the level of meaning, whereas we contact on the level of words. He insisted, therefore, that he could commune with plants and they would obey him. And he proved it. And he insisted that his entire research was based almost entirely upon a conscious cooperation between the plant and himself. That we, as he said, worked together to achieve the end which had been decided to be desirable. That with patience and coaxing and explanation, he made these plants understand what he wanted. And he found them amazingly willing to cooperate, perhaps even more so than average human beings. Recently, experiments have been made of the effect of prayer upon the growth of vegetation. And the results up to this time, though not conclusive and not completely organized as far as the adequate data is concerned, would seem to be positive. Namely, that prayer will hasten the growth of plants. Now, does this mean that it is prayer that is doing it? Or is it, again, this communication on an extrasensory perception level? Is it communication? Is it transfer of energy? Is it man bestowing a certain vitality from himself upon that plant, establishing the rapport between himself and the plant through the conscious focusing of his attention thereon? What is the source of the energy that flows to the plant as the result of prayer? Is this energy actually bestowed by deity? Is this energy made available to man by some mystical or magical pattern of prayer? Or is it the result of man's own communication of life purpose or life meaning to the other kingdom? The talking dogs of Weimar a number of years ago seemed to prove beyond doubt that animals could maintain a fair level of logic, that animals were concerned interiorly with the same problems that we are concerned with, but do not have any means of expressing this to us, unless through some unusual training with an exceptional animal, we are able to establish some symbolic means of exact communication. This was accomplished with these dogs. And these dogs, when asked reasonable questions, answered them reasonably, even though they had had no previous instruction on the subject. Some might hold that the dogs were reading the mind of the person, that they merely picked up our own thinking. This, again, has not been clearly proven one way or another. But if they could pick up this thing, there is no reason to assume that other animals cannot pick it up, or that other kingdoms cannot pick it up. Thus we may find ourselves moving into a universe in which the transmission of pure thought, or the transmission of psychic energy, and the transmission therewith of certain purposes, certain degrees or levels of understanding. But such transmission is within perhaps a comparatively short period of years of being achieved and fulfilled by man. There is also evidence that man's interior mental and brain structure are suitable for such acceptance and such transmission, and that there are undoubtedly areas in the brain available for new functional purposes beyond any that we know at the present time. Let us then assume for a moment what is now not a rash assumption anymore, that the more intense an attitude is held emotionally or mentally, the more likely that attitude is to have an effect outside of the limited area of the person holding the attitude. That the person holding the attitude may be also internally strengthened, or may come to a new orientation in his own nature. But the energy of his will, whether this energy be transmuted or still upon a comparatively base level of ethics, can be communicated. Therefore, selfishness can be communicated, greed can be communicated, hate can be communicated. The development of a means of more intimate and conscious acceptance of this psychic energy also implies the great need for the refinement of this energy itself, with the hope that it will not result in the communication of attitudes which are destructive to the common good. That such negative communication has been achieved also seems rather evident from the long course of history. And we observe that certain attitudes have been tremendously communicated and have resulted in the most tragic consequences to all concerned. In modern religion, therefore, and in metaphysical and mystical groups, circles or groups gathering for prayer, or for meditation, or for some internal resource development, are becoming more commonly discussed and known. Groups of persons in all parts of the world, for example, are uniting as never before in prayer for peace, in the supplication of the divine power to bring security and the end of war and evil. All over the world also, groups are praying for help and maintaining prayer circles to assist those distressed in many ways through the problems of the day. Testimonials flow into these groups continuously. A few years ago, we would have regarded these testimonials with considerable reservation. We would have said that too many of them are probably merely self-hypnosis. And still, a great many of them probably are. But there is still a group to be explained. And this explanation problem cannot be evaded. There is reason to believe that a right attitude held by a group of persons can be felt and experienced. The great problem is to make sure that the attitude is right. The rightness of this attitude must be measured by the basic integrity of its educational communication. And we do not mean by education in this sense doctrine. We mean that the impact of this energy upon the life or lives of those who are receptive to it, that this impact must be essentially right. We do not want to find ourselves in the same predicament we are in television. The average child today spends from 20 to 30 hours a week in front of television. It has become the greatest single force in his life because of his receptivity to it. It is actually a larger moral force in his life than his parents or his school. Yet what is coming across these waves is far from desirable in the majority of cases. And when we start the transmission of pure mental energy, we may be subject to exactly the same difficulty. We don't want the strong-minded criminal contributing to the general delinquency of all mankind. Yet how are we going to reduce or release these barriers which protect us from the mental lives of other people without being influenced by the bad as well as by the good, without receiving negative waves of vibration as well as positive waves? Always these discoveries become a new challenge to our own integrity. We have failed miserably in the television challenge. Can we be expected to do any better on a telepathic level? There could be nothing more disastrous than the breaking down of our barriers by means of which we protect ourselves from mental energies which we cannot digest. There could be nothing more tragic than to break down such barriers and expose us naked to our enemies, which would be just about as serious as the line in the Shakespearean play of Henry VIII would indicate. This means two things. We cannot prevent the motions of progress, but every progress becomes a burden to our spirit, just exactly as the development of atomics has brought with it a terrible fear that is wrenching at our hearts and souls. Any enlargement of our faculty perception will not guarantee the integrity of those perceptions. We may develop and intensify faculties, but this does not mean that we dedicate them or that they are bound to principles able to preserve and protect us. Thus, each new step forward becomes a dilemma, and we move from one dilemma to another down through the course of history. To answer this question thoroughly means to review the whole story of man's moral life. This we cannot do at the moment, but we can perhaps emphasize its particular relation to prayer problem as we sense or see it today. Prayer has two essential purposes, and we cannot divide them completely. Assuming that man, as he now experiences his needs, is seeking through prayer to achieve a mood, he is seeking to restore, by means of prayer phenomena, a positive relationship between himself and life. He is attempting to enter a state of conscious rapport with reality, with the eternal principle for which philosophy has given such terms as spirit, consciousness, truth, being, essence. Man, through prayer, seeks a correct relationship between himself and eternity. This correct relationship, so far as he can experience it today, is one of gentle humility. The recognition of his own need. The recognition of his own imperfection. The realization that up to the present time, he has never known enough to be inspired to a common, united action in harmony with truth. He has never had sufficient realization to understand why he was here. He's never had sufficient courage to live according to the essential principles that he does understand. Therefore, his need at the moment is so real, and his own position is so inadequate, that as far as fact and essence are concerned, he is in a position of entreaty. He is not asking, however, to be saved from himself. He is not asking to be preserved in violation to law. He is asking to have the insight, the understanding, and the spiritual integrity to know what is right and do it. Therefore, his prayer is that he shall be conscious of the divine plan as it relates to him and to those of his kind and to nature around him. He asks that he may have insight into the law, which is the will of God for its creatures. And out of this insight, he asks also the internal moral support which will assist him to live what he knows and to keep the faith that he discovers. Such kind of internal prayer, silent prayer perhaps, meditational prayer, is consequently intended to create a mood in him, a movement of his own spiritual nature, a relaxation away from worldliness, a temporary separation from outwardness and from all the pressures and selfishness which moves the external world around us. He asks to have the power to know, which means that he has to become receptive. He has to beseech. He has to ask. He has to need. He has to pass through certain experiences in which he comes finally to realize that without interior strength, his cause is lost, and that this strength must come from a power superior to himself. This recognition, this relaxation toward God, is expressed by means of entreaty, not by groveling, not by the same abjection as with which the ancient people mutilated themselves before the altars of their gods, but certainly a dignified and gentle statement of real need and of earnest desire to meet that need, and the recognition that the supply for the meeting of that need must come from a divine source. Thus, entering into a comparatively relaxed state, the person opens himself to the inflow of a mystical energy which up to now he has not recognized and not permitted to have its perfect work in him. His own mind and his own attitude also become sources of energy movement, and he locks himself by his attitude, creating walls of defensive energy through which the natural motion of life cannot come. Opinions, attitudes, prejudices, these are actual living walls of energy, negative energy. And these walls not only keep out the enemy, but also keep out the life which is the eternal friend. Thus, we have to relax against this opinionation, this self-sufficiency, this belief that with our abilities, with our sciences, with our art, with our crafts, with our policies, we can defeat the unknown. This end we cannot achieve. In our prayerfulness, we simply attempt to attune ourselves to an energy which is everywhere in space and is eternally available. If we can experience this peace, this calmness, this quietness, then it is possible through extrasensory transmission to project it or to create a condition by which another person can become aware on a level better than that of exterior communication alone. Here we fall directly into the Zen concept. For over 1,000 years, the masters of Zen have communicated the doctrine without speaking, nor have they made use of symbols, or have they had their disciples read the instructions. The communication is entirely psychic. It is the communication of the experience of one person, the master experience, transmitted inwardly to his disciples as a series of experiences. And these fragments of experiences are symbolically concealed behind the title of the koan, which is actually a fragment of impact, of energy, between the master and the disciple. If it is possible, therefore, to communicate a doctrine by the ability of transmission by the mind alone, how is this done? If the mastermind, the teacher, the Zen master, projected a positive, dramatic, despotic attitude, he could overcome his disciples' resistance by something resembling oratory, if it was spoken word, or by debate, or by dispute, or by the hypnotic force of a command which could not be resisted. All of such methods are wrong and would never be used in the transmission of true experience. The purpose that is necessary is that both the master and the disciple reach a condition of the complete transcendence of themselves, the complete suspension of their own personal attitude, and in this way, suddenly experience that they always have been in communication. The thing that prevented the expression of the communication consisted of two separate patterns of attitude, which in their aggressive form could not be communicated. When both attitudes, that of the receiving person and of the sending person, when both attitudes are held in complete suspension, reality moves freely through these channels, and pure consciousness mingles with pure consciousness, resulting in a common experience. And it is this experience in common which is the real end toward which mystical meditation and prayer have always aimed. The purpose of prayer being this mingling of personal consciousness with a universal source of true strength and integrity. A mingling for no ulterior motive whatsoever. Not a mingling in order that we can get well from sickness, or that we can exchange poverty for wealth, or that we can dispose of unnecessary and unwelcome relations. These are not the ends of prayer. The purpose is to establish a mood of complete correctness, of such utter and inevitable rightness in ourselves, that all of the attitudes which we hold wrongly no longer continue to operate. With this condition, we remove the cause of misery. For the cause of misery is the interval between man and God. And as man, through mystical experiences, attains the consciousness of being, that consciousness has in it nothing of selfishness and nothing of self-purpose. It is universal purpose moving into manifestation, with man accepting with gratitude and gentleness that which the infinite in its wisdom eternally provides. Prayer in this sense, then, becomes the possibility of reestablishing the ancient mystical bridge, and as such becomes a very prominent and positive force in healing. Healing is actually achieved in most instances by the correction of a root cause in man. Now, it is not possible nor expected that man shall achieve all things quickly. As one old sage pointed out, man has to die many times in order to learn how to live once. But the fact remains that much can gradually be achieved by proper degrees, but not by force and pressure. Thus, in prayer therapy, the purpose is to change the relationship of the individual towards his energy problem. The great thing to be achieved as possible is to bring to this person the power or the experience of peace, the experience of acceptance, the experience of recognizing that the interior contrition of his own consciousness is his prayer. True prayer is to live in the state of prayerfulness. And this state of prayerfulness is the state of the eternal acceptance of God. A man cannot hope at this time to live in that state continually. But he can hope to experience it occasionally, as Plotinus did. He can hope that one or two mystical experiences in the course of a lifetime may so consecrate him that he shall know the truth of all things. Not because he rationalizes it, but because he experiences it by the complete act of faith. It would be quite conceivable, therefore, that prayer in the churches and in religious organizations could gradually become a very powerful and purposeful branch of therapy. The very least that could be accomplished is that prayer would be a handmaiden upon the sciences, that they would prepare the individual for the mystery of his own recovery. They would prepare him to accept whatever services were necessary on the part of science, without prejudice, without conceit, without overestimation or underestimation. And nothing could be of greater value to the sincere physician than a sincere patient who has the proper attitude with which to approach the improvement of health. The physician today has not only to fight with the bodily ills, but with the whole chain of psychic complaints, which are largely responsible for many ailments that now seem to arise within the flesh itself. No medication on the outside can solve these psychic complaints. The psychologist tries to solve them, but something essentially important is missing. And that something in the patient's experience is veneration. The patient may respect the psychologist, but he does not have the proper emotional outlet. The only emotional outlet that he may develop is dangerous, and that's transference, in which he will become overly personally attached to his physician. What he needs is a true emotional release. And this true emotional release comes through the relaxation of his psychic life into the beautiful experience of something valuable. If the person can come to believe and know that he has the power to take a correct attitude toward God, and that this correct attitude has been called prayer, it is the complete relaxation of himself away from the world and the acceptance into himself of the full impact of universal truth or principle. Through prayer, man experiences this to a measure. He experiences a little relaxation. He senses the importance of quiet. Even when he gathers with others in church, the quiet moments of prayer give him a sense of belonging, not merely to this world, but to the whole universe, which is the religious mystery. And in these quiet moments, there is a natural refreshment. There is a relief from psychic stress. There is a temporary suspension of worldliness. Through the continual development of prayer, this experience can be largened. It can be made more continuous and more important. It can, however, also lead us to certain escape mechanisms which we must protect ourselves against. We are not supposed to take away from our daily work vast amount of time to use in beseeching deity. What we are supposed to do is to discover also that in our work is our prayer, and that prayer is a general attitude toward everything that we do, in which every action, thought, and emotion becomes an offering upon the altar of eternal truth. If we can achieve this type of realization, sickness will have a tendency to clear. Many ailments that have nothing but tension as a cause will very quickly respond. Ailments which perhaps have already become so chronic that they have affected the flesh, although they might have been of psychic beginnings, may respond more slowly. But that which cannot be cured can then be carried with dignity, with understanding, and with patience, and with a full realization that we live in a just universe, and that the things that are happening to us are the natural results of our own conduct. If we then take this more relaxed, honorable position, we can do a great deal. If groups of persons taking this attitude meet together for a common purpose, there can now apparently be no doubt that the single effort is intensified, and that if persons with a correct attitude and a correct understanding, if enough of them did unite in prayer, there would ultimately be peace. Not only because they prayed together, but because the prayer must so affect them that they can no longer fight each other. The prayer, therefore, is not only a beseeching of God to bestow peace, but the very beseeching is the winning of peace in ourselves. Therefore, when we ask God to bestow love, we ask a strange question, or to make a strange request, because actually deity is love. Therefore, can never deprive anything of its own nature. What we are asking is that we may experience it. And the only reason we do not experience it is ourselves. Thus, prayer must create the mood of receptivity. It is not only the supplication, but the bridge, by means of which the supplication can be caused to achieve its own end or proper purpose. Prayer can help the individual who is sick, because it will take away from him the rebellion, the tension, and the stress. It will help him to carry with serenity what problems of recuperation he must pass through. Prayer will help the person who is alone to escape the neurosis of loneliness, because prayer gives us the experience that we cannot be alone, that loneliness is isolation due to our own false thinking. Little by little, the receptivity to prayer, the acceptance of it into our own consciousness, becomes therapy. We gradually achieve a state of vibration in which we relax the false tensions of our own energy. And into this quietude can flow the experience which we have previously locked out by our own aggressive and non-effective feelings. Most of us, to a measure, are rebels. Rebellion is our common experience. We fight against that which hurts us. We arm ourselves against the unknown. We struggle desperately by all kinds of aggressive means to achieve purposes which we desire. We live and die of our own aggressiveness. And today we suffer greatly because of it. This aggressiveness locks us away from the quiet world of all things that are sold. It makes us fight for something that is already so close to us that we cannot see it. It makes us strive desperately for distant benefits when the greatest benefit is at our very door. It makes us strive to find happiness in all the things around us, uncertain though they be, and denies us of the experience of knowing true happiness by communion with the thing within us. So prayer can set many of these problems right for us. And the development of it as a means of therapy is legitimate. It is another level. Psychology works with the problems of the mind. Prayer is a therapy for the heart. And as the heart must ever rule the mind, by the very nature of man, that which goes into the deeper part of him has the greatest benefit. So there will sometime be a complete religious mysticism of transmutation, or the transforming of man's inner life through these mystical sacraments, of which prayer is probably one of the most common and familiar. So we do feel that prayer today is a vital force, and the more completely it is disseminated, the more it may achieve its end, and the more it will accomplish the reformation of the one who prays. For out of the true and earnest experience of prayer, man comes to a better life than he may previously have known. And once having enjoyed it, he will sustain it to the best of his ability. Thank you very much.